delighted to, I'm actually really delighted that we're a small and manageable group, because I really do want to have a conversation, a set of discussions, and a set of stories and observations from you all. So let me just set it up a little bit. I'm Joey Kressman. I come from Chicago, where my spouse Ingrid and I have lived for a long time and work and learn in. I direct something called the Asset-Based Community Development, ABCD, Institute at Northwestern University. It's a group that has, we've had the privilege of working with communities across the United States and on five different continents on a particular way of thinking about how you build strong communities. And I'll say a little bit about that, but the major focus of our conversation today is sort of how congregations and communities interact in ways that are mutually beneficial and synergistic. How many people here, I did a kind of introduction to asset-based community development on Tuesday, which is like a century ago. I'm sort of assuming that not very many. Anybody, was anybody there? Okay, a couple of you anyway. So let me just do what took me an hour and 10 minutes to do last time in about 3 minutes, if I can, to give you a little bit of a sense of the overall set of approaches. And then I'll say a few things about what we've learned from congregations who do this kind of work, and where I'd like us to have our conversation here today. The work comes out of years of work in neighborhoods in Chicago and in cities and smaller towns as well across the United States and now beyond, trying to figure out what are the ingredients of making healthy communities. And most of the work has been centered in struggling communities, in lower-income communities in cities, in struggling rural communities in small towns where the farming has collapsed, or the coal mines have closed, or Native people's reservations, places that are really hard up against it. And I think what we're constantly coming up against is a kind of a fork in the road. We're collecting stories. We're story collectors, and that's what I want to do today, is collect your stories a little bit. And we've collected thousands of stories about successful efforts where people have taken the, parks back from the drug dealers and have turned schools around and have created jobs and made things happen that are positive in communities. And we collected a whole bunch of those some years ago in a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out, which has become a kind of major guidebook for people who do community development here and elsewhere. And what we found in collecting these stories was a set of patterns. And briefly, the patterns had to do with this reality, the half-full, half-empty glass. And the simple-minded idea here is that this glass is true of every one of us as individuals. Everybody here has deficiencies and needs and problems and challenges. I think that's sort of Lutheran confessions, right? But we also clearly are people with gifts and skills and capacities. And I think the central lesson that we have run into over and over and over again is when communities get stronger, it means that somebody has seen the central fact about this glass, which is that one part of it is pretty useless and the other part of it is very useful. And we have seen, I think, over and over again, particularly in struggling communities, that folks have been taught to see only one part of the glass, the empty part of the glass. So when you think about communities that are in trouble, that have all kinds of problems, you are likely to be thinking about, if I can find the right overhead here, this kind of a map in your head. This is a needs map. Think about a inner city community or a public housing development or maybe even a Native people's reservation. This kind of a set of definitions comes to mind. And I think our central finding has always been, or has built up over the years, that this is a useless map, that this is a map that one of my favorite teachers, who is a wonderful community builder, called a prison. If this is the only map of a community that exists, it's like people have been put into a prison. And the way to break out of a prison, which, by the way, has extraordinarily negative consequences, if that's the idea we have about a community, it's got consequences that are just devastating. People begin to think that they are deficient themselves. They internalize that idea. They don't look to their neighbors for help because all the resources are out there someplace, not in here, right? They reward, they're constantly getting more money to come into the community by reporting how much they failed. So you get more government grants if you've got more teen pregnancies this year than you did last year. I don't know if your dropout rate is higher. So there's a whole set of institutional dynamics built upon this emphasis on the empty part of the glass. And so almost all of our work now has been centered on people who really get serious about the alternative. Say, you know, we have to find out what our assets are, what our full part of the glass really looks like. And I think one of the findings that we keep running into is that each community is absolutely unique, but on the other hand, each community, the uniqueness is defined by a set of relationships among six different categories of assets. So when we think about a community now, we think about a set of resources that are uniquely related to each other. And I'll just go through them very briefly. And I'll be thinking a little bit about your congregations here as well. We think that in communities, Dan, that every community, no matter how poor or wealthy, has some unique combination of these six things, these six resources. Think about them as ingredients in a cake, maybe, or something. But even in the most struggling community, you have people who live there, all of whom have a full part of the glass, all of whom have talents and skills and gifts. You have a community that is filled with voluntary associations, including so many that come out of congregations, places where people do things with each other, whether it's worship or work in the community or celebration or athletics or reading together, so that the voluntary community groups and networks are absolutely critical category of assets. And third, we've got all kinds of governmental, non-governmental agencies, NGOs of all kinds, and the difference between category two and three is category three is the place where we get together as human beings and we get paid for doing what we're doing. And category two is where we don't get paid, but it's critically important. Fourth, every community has some combination of physical assets, rural or urban, land and the buildings and the infrastructure and transportation. Every community, fifth, has economic assets. Even the lowest income community has people who produce things and people who consume things. And finally, every community has its stories, the heritage stories, the value stories. Who are we as a people? Who are we as a community? What are the stories that you get when you ask that kind of a question? So we have been interested in all of the incredibly various ways in which people have gotten serious about unfolding those kinds of assets and drawing their own kind of a map. This is a little bit probably too detailed, but what are all the voluntary associations? That's that column over there. What are our institutions down here? How about our stories? Can we collect those? What about the local economy? Our physical assets? And what can our individual members and residents do? So we're basically looking at a kind of a paradigm shift here, where we've had a way of doing business, particularly in struggling communities, that had, I think, a set of pretty negative outcomes, and we're trying to shift, we're seeing the shift actually, from this column, we could call it a social service model, to a community building model. And here are some of the dimensions on which we think the shift depends. In the older model, what we always do is need surveys. What are the problems here? Let's count the dropout rate and the crime rate. Concentrate on bringing resources from the outside to solve those problems. A successful community building model starts rather with assets. What do we have here to build on? What can we start with? How can we connect them? The older way, first of all, focuses on problems, and it's a problem response kind of a dynamic, and instead we're seeing probably it's more successful to at least add to that constantly being on the lookout for opportunities. The third one, let me explain for just a second. If you're in a lower income community and you want money from the government or from the Ford Foundation or maybe from the ELCA, what you have to do is to hold your hand out in a charity pose and convince the donor that things are bad enough that you deserve the money, right? That they're really going to pour in the solutions from outside. And I think we have seen that that's a dead end, that it just leads to more and more dependency and usually doesn't guarantee anything more than survival. And so we're more and more interested in what it is to change from charity to investment. What's the kind of deal that we can make? So if Ford Foundation wants to invest in a community, they want to know, what community folks, what have you got and what have you done to connect what you've got? And can we invest in what you've got so that you're the first problem solver and we're the investor in your problem solving capacity? Does that make sense? So it's that charity to investment kind of. And this, by the way, is sometimes a hard one for church people. We might want to come back to that. Some church people, I think, we're addicted to charity. We need to be needed. I think the usual approach is to emphasize human service agencies and other professionalized problem solvers. And I think this approach asks us at least to add an emphasis on local voluntary associations. Let's get not only the churches, but the block clubs and the cultural groups and the softball teams and all of the reading groups and all the ways in which people get together. Let's invite them to the table and get them to be part of the action. Mostly that social service model, because it's kind of clinical in nature, focuses on individuals. And here we're really trying to shift a little bit to say, now what's the community look like as the context for health and wholeness for people, right? We used to sort of count the number of services offered, and that seems to us to be more of a dead end. If we can figure out ways to give people power themselves, to act and to solve problems, that might work a lot better. We understand power differently. It's not the office you hold or the credential you have. It's the relationships that are the powerful actors, I think, both in communities and congregations. Rather than looking only for programs, we're looking to connect people as the answers more often. And we're thinking not so much about people as clients or recipients. That, in a sense, those are words for the empty part of the glass. If you're a client or a recipient, you're likely to be defined as empty. Instead, we're sort of thinking about what is it like to focus on citizens. Let me pause there. Does that make sense? Are you following generally where we're going here? Any reactions to this? Questions? I saw some heads nodding, and I didn't think I saw anybody going, "Wow!" But
yeah, I can see how, both from the standpoint of those who are the outsiders coming in to work in the community and from the inside out, how that shift would be challenging. What's your experience from those inside a community who are used to putting the hand out as the way of getting investment? Shifting paradigms, and what's your experience of how people go about making that shift on that end?
Yeah, it's a wonderful
challenge.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Let me talk about it partly with a comment on this fifth consequence, because I think in a sense one of the things that the growth of this dependency idea has had is the emergence of a new kind of a leader in many communities. When I was trained as a community organizer many years ago, this guy Saul Alinsky used to say, your first job when you go into a neighborhood that you're not from is to find the natural leaders. Where are the, in DC, he would say every community has them. They're not the elected officials, they're not the people who are visible from downtown, but it's the people on the block who everybody else turns to solve problems, right? Those are the natural leaders. Today, though, because we've shifted in some ways, we now have people who are called leaders in communities whose major characteristic as a leader is that they raise money from the outside. They're really good at raising money. And if you look then at how they do that, their major skill as a leader is holding their hands out and making sure that City Hall or ELCA knows how bad things are here, and therefore will pour resources in. So in a sense, the leadership skill has shifted from somebody who can get something done with their neighbors to somebody whose major skill is denigrating their neighbors, right? Which is a different kind of leadership. Now, so that's at the leadership level, that's a challenge for some. I think our almost universal experience, particularly in struggling communities, is that this way of thinking about their reality is experienced as liberating. That most of the folks in struggling communities understand that they have been taught to play a game. And the game has involved hold your hand out and look poor and make sure we know that. But they operate in their daily lives 99% of the time on the full part of the West. They'd never survive if they didn't. So they look to neighbors, they look to each other, they understand how to organize block clubs and block watches and how to work through their churches. And it's a set of activities at the local level which is entirely based on the full part of the West. And so in a sense, this language sort of gets a lot of people to say, thank God we can, you know, acknowledge what the reality is. And we don't have to play this game talking to the outside world as if our reality is our emptiness. Rachel?
Well, I was just reminded when you were talking about Putnam's book called Bowling Alone.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot about the changes in communities and how social capital is his phrase for what you kind of had as the
associations
and networks and stuff. And he said, you know, there's been a huge decline in associations and official associations and networks and the ways that people are together in local communities, except for in the churches. And he noticed that church and religious organizations are the ones that have stayed the same or increased, whereas like bowling leagues and, you know, that's his little fun model, but other types of, you know, brotherhoods of electrical workers, all of that kind of stuff has declined quite a bit in the last, you know, couple decades, but that churches and religious organizations are still really strong sources of social capital. So
right.
just kind of adding on to what you're saying, but his book is really good for looking at how social capital works and how we need it, and to kind of add on to some of what you're saying about.
I agree, that's the good part of the book. Yeah, he's a good friend of ours. I appear fairly frequently on panels with him and so on, and we do disagree, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the disagreement is, Bob, can you really see, sitting at Harvard up here, can you see down into the streets in the south side of Chicago and really know what the relationships are there? You can see the churches, maybe, but can you see the block clubs, and can you see the card playing groups and the networks of folks who all came from the same small town in Mississippi, right, and who still, you know, congregate together. I mean, there's a hugely lively associational life if you actually look at the community and start counting them, that I don't think Bob gets from Harvard. But, the other thing about it is he discovered after he wrote, do you know what we're talking about here? This book, wonderful book, Bowling Alone. It is a terrific book, but he found himself often before audiences all over the United States and beyond, having the effect of completely depressing people. And he got really tired of that after a while. We would sort of come on after him and debunk a little bit of what he was saying and try to get people to sit up in their chairs again, you know.
What's his name here?
Robert Putnam. And the book is called Bowling Alone. But his next book, he hastened to do another book called Better Together, which is really a report of a lot of the activity that in fact does exist for social capital. But it is a terrific book for understanding the importance, as Rachel was saying, of social capital. So that's the kind of background I think we're interested in then. In a sense, how do you understand a local congregation as a set of assets? So, for example, you could understand a congregation as made up of personnel, including the members and their skills and capacities, the constituencies outside the congregation, the space and facilities, the material and equipment, the expertise, resident in the congregation, the networks of connections, the economic power. So part of the work that we do with organizations has to do with, can you look in the mirror in a more powerful way and get away from the sort of poor mouthing? You know, we never have enough money, we never have enough staff, we can't possibly meet the demands on us. And begin to take a look at what you've actually got. And one of the things I think that constantly happens with people in nonprofit organizations, including congregations when they do this kind of work, is they move, if you will, from a scarcity mindset to an abundance mindset. They start always with, we don't have enough, our budget will never carry us, we've got to be dependent on the ELCA, or we've got to, if we're a community group, we have to be dependent on City Hall. And when they start looking at all the stuff they've got, somewhat systematically, you can see a change. And you know, they still wake up with a problem in the morning, but the problem is, what are we going to do with all the stuff we've got? Not, we don't have enough stuff, how can we get some more stuff? So I think what we're interested in basically is the question of, how do you recognize the gifts and capacities inside congregations and mobilize those for the well-being of the congregation itself internally? I think that's a powerful question that we're very interested in. And then secondly, we're interested in a series of questions about the relationships between congregations and communities. A lot of the, at least initial sets of stories and cases are collected in a workbook we did called Asset-Based Strategies for Faith Communities, that sort of reports activity at the congregational level, at the synodical level, and adjudicatory level, in seminaries in terms of curriculum, at a whole series of levels within the life of the church, where people have made this kind of a shift and begun thinking about the full part of the glass rather than the empty part. Let me say one more thing about the second category, the congregations and communities category, because there's so much going on, as I'm sure you know. And then let's just open it up for some stories or observations that you might have. I think about the relationship between congregations that have discovered their own capacity to interact with the community and what happens then, in sort of four categories. The first and the most prevalent still is the congregation sees itself as filled with caring people who have skills and commitments, and they enter into service relationships with the community. So they start a starter support at a soup kitchen, or they tutor or counsel in the local schools, or they're providing some kind of a set of services for people. I think that's the most traditional way of congregation. But I think there are three others that are much more exciting and more stretching that you probably know about, in no particular order. You must know that there are thousands of congregations across the United States that are involved in congregation-based community organizing, that are part of, most often they're part of four national networks of congregation-based community organizing, and they relate powerfully to other congregations in a particular city or region, and decide on sets of issues that are important to act upon, and act upon them in powerful ways that affect public policy and affect community well-being. So we can talk about that some. All four networks are sort of in different parts of the country, and they're very powerful, I think, sets of resources for all of us. Secondly, lots of congregations have, sometimes moving out of community organizing, have got into community development, which is a related kind of set of activities, but it tends to be more characterized by congregations getting involved, for example, in the creation of jobs, or in the production of affordable housing, or some kind of a development activity that's rooted in the perceived needs of the community that they're working in. So it's, the first is service, second community organizing, third community development, and then it's not really a separate category, but there are a good number of congregations now that are working on some kind of an ABCD, some kind of an asset-based community development set of approaches, where they're systematically looking at the gifts and strengths of their own congregation, then looking systematically at the gifts and strengths of the community around them and linking the two, trying to figure out how they come together. Let me just end then with one quick story about that. So there, you know, a lot of stories in asset-based strategies. On the community development side, we have learned an immense amount from a terrific small Lutheran congregation on the west side of Chicago called Bethel Lutheran. Do you, people know about Bethel New Life a little bit, right? This, I won't tell the whole story, but this tiny, tiny Lutheran congregation on the west side of Chicago. The whole west side changed racially from white to black in a period of about 6 years. This congregation is still all white, slowly began getting black members, and had to decide whether to close their doors or not. And they decided they would stay. And then they decided, in the words of Mary Nelson, who was the founder and sister of the pastor at that time, if we didn't do something to save the neighborhood, we wouldn't have a neighborhood to be at the church of, right? So it was in their self-interest to do this. What they did was they began pooling their money, and they got a couple hundred dollars, and they bought a dilapidated, abandoned, three-flat apartment building a block away from the church for just a couple hundred dollars. It was on the tax rolls. And then for the next 6 months, the members, after church on Sunday morning, trooped down to this building and taught themselves drywalling and carpentry and painting, and they rehabbed the apartment building, right? And when they rehabbed the apartment building, they rented it out. It was one of the best places in the neighborhood to live. And with the rental money, then they bought a second one and then a third one. So you fast forward to today, and it's a $13.5 million a year community development group. They've rehabbed or built anew over 1,100 units of affordable housing in this community. They have either created or placed about 8,000 people in living wage jobs. Their outlook is just militantly asset-based. They will look at a rubble-strewn empty lot and don't even see the rubble. They see, number one, this is a wonderful recycling opportunity, right? Let's create some jobs recycling. And then if the lot happens to be a brownfield, that is a contaminated old industrial lot that's still too toxic to build on, oh, here's some more jobs. We'll train some people on how to clean up brownfields, and they'll do that. And then the lot represents for them affordable housing, or represents a playground or a community garden, right? So they're constantly looking around in that way. One of their, related to Ingrid's work, one of my favorite programs of theirs these days, one of their efforts. There are thousands of people coming back into the west side of Chicago each year from prison. People mostly that we locked up for minor drug offenses in the early 1990s, right? And now they're coming out of jail. So something like 5,000 people a year come back into this set of communities out of prison. And Bethel has constructed a set of approaches that they named Welcome Home. The name of the effort. And so people coming out of prison have a whole array of relationships and possibilities put in front of them that might lead to jobs and relationships with congregations and other people in the community. So that's one. Let me tell you one other quick story. Anybody here from the Twin Cities? Do you know when I say the word Mercado Central, does that mean anything to you? Mercado Central?
Have you heard of that? The International, or the New International Square, whatever they call it.
Yeah, down on the south side, South Minneapolis.
Yeah, yeah. Phillips neighborhood.
Yeah, it's just south of Phillips.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me very briefly tell you the story behind it. It was one of these community organizing networks, faith-based community organizing networks in the Twin Cities, called Interfaith Action at that time. Different name now. But particularly the Catholic churches that were part of that network began noticing the influx of new immigrants from Mexico and Central America. And the first thing the conversations with these new immigrants got the folks to understand was, we don't have any Spanish-speaking masses in our parishes here. It's time we took care of that. So they took care of that. And then they started to get to know their new neighbors, and they noticed that they were all either unemployed or underemployed, right? That they were not integrated into the economy. And then they had a radical idea, and the radical idea was, what do you think these people did before they came? Did they have a life before they came to Minneapolis? And what could we do with them if we knew, right? And so they started a series of one-on-one interviews with the new immigrants, asking them mainly, what did you do in your village in Mexico or in El Salvador? And particularly they were interested in enterprise. And nobody knew the word entrepreneur coming up from Latin America. So they would ask questions like, did you ever make money on the side to help support your family? And so they started getting stories. Almost everybody had, you know, made clothing or crafts of some kind, or cooked tortillas that they were selling. And so the next set of questions was, well, did you enjoy doing that? And would that be something you would be interested in doing in your new home here in Twin Cities? And so it didn't take them long to get about 50 takers, 50 new immigrant folks who said, you know, I would love to have a small business here. And so they organized these 50 into a kind of group and put it through, I won't go through the whole story, but a very sort of sophisticated two-year business planning process. And the outcome of it was the Mercado Central. And they found an abandoned industrial building in South Minneapolis, part of a very dilapidated, at that point, neighborhood. And they got it for a very, very good price, got some city support to do that. And if you go there today, it's a huge space that feels like you're in a square in Mexico City, and it's filled with small businesses, and restaurants, and craft shops, and all kinds of musical instrument shops, and it's just a wonderful place, and it has become the center for the Hispanic community in the upper Midwest. And now it has also become a kind of destination point for white and African American people who don't have the money to go all the way to Mexico. You can just go to the south side of Minneapolis. You are, right?
Much more convenient.
That's right. And it's a real success story. It has spun off then this sort of, other ethnic groups. There's a couple now of Somali centers in Minneapolis. And this is stuff that Luther should really be engaged in, Chris. It's really
great. Take a note.
What is the name?
Mercado Central. Central Market.
What was the church?
It was a series of churches,
oh,
right?
So
part of Catholic interfaith action.
Is it in the faith?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Oh, that's that one.
Okay. All right. And just to finish, it really did turn into an economic development engine for that part of the city. They now, I think the last time I heard, about 15 of the businesses that started out in very small spaces within the Mercado outgrew them. And they went out on the street and bought abandoned storefronts. And so the whole street now has become a lively commercial center filled with all kinds of economic activities. And, again, that all started with somebody having this radical idea that folks probably had some skills from the old country that they brought with them, which is something that I think all of our immigrant experiences also were teaching us. So let me stop there and see if we can collect some stories that you might have of congregations that have gotten serious about their own resources to use them internally, or have interacted in interesting ways with the communities around them. Yeah.
Just a quick question before we get to that. I mean, as a congregational leader, how does one find out about these kinds of networks that are active in the area? I mean, this is totally new to me. I'm really fascinated. But how do you find out about interfaith action or something like that?
I think you just ask questions. It's a networking process. There's going to be, if you sort of look around, where are you? Are you in Twin Cities?
I'm moving to the Twin Cities this next year. So,
okay.
Did you come to the
alderman? Maybe, but that wouldn't be the first thing I would do, because sometimes the aldermen or the city officials are people who get beat up by these groups and don't like them very much.
But the four big networks, you could name
you
the
four,
so
the four big
website.
Networks are, let me just kick them off.
Yeah.
The oldest one is called the Industrial Areas Foundation, IAF, and they are very heavy on the East Coast and in the Southwest, and particularly in Texas. They're very powerful. In Texas, they even got George Bush working with them when he was governor. They're very good at getting the attention of public figures. A second one is the Gamaliel Foundation, named after the acolyte of St. Paul, GAMALIEL, and they are most active in the Midwest, and they are the group that has the Twin Cities Network, which is not called Interfaith any longer.
Isaiah.
That's exactly right. It's called Isaiah. And lots of Lutheran churches are involved in that as well, Chris, right?
Yep.
And a third one is called PICO, P-I-C-O, the Pacific Institute for Community Organizing. And that started out as a West Coast operation, but now it's in Denver, New Orleans, and then you guys have started in Florida as well. And Richard, you've worked with them some, is that right? And then the fourth one is called DART, Direct Action and Research Training Institute, DART. And they tend to be, they're out of Miami and tend to be a little bit more concentrated in the Southeast. So those are the four major networks. There are other interesting organizing networks as well. And just, let me just say, on the community development front, the Bethel story, that the national group there is called CCDA, the Christian Community Development Association. And it's made up of hundreds of congregations. They tend to be, you know, quite evangelical congregations, and not as much Catholic, but some Lutheran. And CCDA has probably now, I don't know, 600 congregation members, and they're all over the United States.
And they have great annual conferences, too, that you can attend to learn more about their work or how to get involved, or just to learn a lot of it.
That's what Bethel's part of, you said?
Yeah, Bethel's certainly part of that. So Bethel is also part of the Chicago area, Industrial Areas Foundation organizing efforts. So congregations can be parts of numbers of these efforts at once.
Thanks a lot. That's that helps a lot.
Okay.
Just know a few names.
You and Chris ought to work together to make sure you're exploring turf up in the Twin Cities. And where are you in the Twin Cities?
Oh, South Minneapolis.
Okay.
I have part story, part question. My home church is in Seattle, actually, Mary Nelson's brother, John Nelson.
John, right? Absolutely,
he was my pastor there for a long time.
The South
Central
Children,
Lutheran.
Right?
Yeah, so we had a community lunch program for many years that's now its own nonprofit. But one thing, now I'm living up here for a year, but occasionally when I'm in town, I'll try to help out. If they generally have different groups that come and cook the meals, but it always takes place at our church on Tuesdays and Fridays. And so historically, there'd be a lot of volunteers from our church who would do our month of meals. And I've noticed the last several times I've gone to work there that they're trying to kind of empower the guests that come for the meals and let them help out with jobs, you know, set out the desserts or whatever. But I noticed the last time I went and worked, it didn't feel fun anymore to me, because it wasn't sort of our group of congregational members, and the people that were being empowered sort of were really taking their power and were sort of directing the whole thing and telling other people to back off, no, it should be this way, and everybody sort of wanted their little piece of the power. And so I'm wondering, you think in general, I think that's a good thing to sort of get the groups mixing and get to know, but what's a good way to sort of make that transition and then not just lose all your old volunteers? Like, well, he told me to do it this other way, and I don't like working with him. And so the senior citizens that used to like to come do it together, they don't really come anymore. And it's just growing pains, I guess, but what do you have any sort of key suggestions for how to help that transition, or
any thoughts?
I just kind of, in sharing, my church doesn't do anything formally in terms of one of these organizations, but one thing that we do, it's a bilingual church. We have Mandarin and English congregation. The Mandarin is now much larger than the English speaking congregation. We have co-pastors. But one thing we do to hold our congregation together, because it is one congregation, is we eat together every Sunday after the service. So it's not seen as a service meal for the community, but we do invite anybody who is there on Sunday to eat with us. It's a very kind of egalitarian way of doing a meal. And so we definitely have, I'd say we have about 100 member church people every Sunday. It's not huge. But then we, and the church has a small budget for buying two big pans of Chinese food from a restaurant that we know of. we make a huge theme room rice, and then we have people sign up to bring other foods, like, to add to that. So it's kind of half potluck, half there is always something, so we always have some base. And then we ask, first-time visitors, is always free, you know, please just eat. And then everybody else, adults, we ask $2 donation, children, $1 donation, something like that. But it's nobody's paying attention. It's very much like just put it in. People don't sometimes, whatever. But, and we have members serve, and then we all eat together. And I think, like, what I love about that is we always have at least 10 people from our neighborhood. Who knows if they're homeless or actually in need of food or if they just want to stop by for lunch. But some of them have become members of our church, you know. So it is empowering in the sense because it's not a, we like you as a poor person who's coming to eat, to serve food here, but to eat together. And I know that some of the places now do, a lot of the meal places do eating together with people instead of serving from behind a counter. And theologically, as well as socially, I think this is a really important step for churches to sit down with people and eat meals together. And then, you know, like I said, I really love the way we do it because it's a part of our Sunday service.
Yeah.
And anybody who wants to comes in. We often now, like, people will come in kind of towards the middle of the service or the end of the service. You know, maybe they do it because they feel like they should, but it's also, like, nobody's keeping track. You know, it's like, if you want to come and you want to participate in our prayer time, feel free. You know, like, if you don't, nobody's going to say anything. So I think there's a sense of empowerment just by eating with and being with people. So I don't know if that's, like, it's not a solution, but it's an idea of how to do meals in a way that I think is, for me, really theologically, a different way of doing it, to eat together around a common table rather than to serve from a safe behind a counter place. And I think that helps break down kind of the differences between who can afford to eat and that kind of thing, too. So.
I think that's right. I told a story, and I won't tell it again, but just briefly, I told a story about a soup kitchen that really has taught us a lot. And I think I've talked with John about it, so he's probably been thinking about this some. Where in a big soup kitchen in Cincinnati, they interviewed all the folks coming in for a meal about gifts and skills and dreams, and they found out what their gifts and skills and dreams were, and then started working with them on how to fulfill their dreams using their gifts and skills. And the first thing that they did after they started this, besides sort of making what they call a wall of fame, celebrating what they found, making it visible, was to in fact change the rules of the soup kitchen so everybody ate together.
Mm-hmm.
And it really did make a huge difference. And there was some pushback at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think people were sort of pushed beyond their safety zone in some ways, but it grew to the point now where a lot of people are very comfortable with it and not only come in to volunteer, but bring their families with them to eat and all of that.
One thing that part of our Scandinavian heritage is a reticence to actually talk about how we're feeling about the process of things. And that's certainly true in a lot of congregations. I'm wondering if you could provide opportunity and encouragement for people to talk about how this is impacting them and you know, create purposeful times for conversation for the old ladies so that the conversation about how it's impacting them isn't happening, you know, on the side or they just don't show up anymore. But there's an opportunity to purposefully talk about that and maybe to also invite in the conversation other, you know, the people who are now taking over and how that is for them. I think every time we get an opportunity for people to hear directly from another person how it's impacting them, and it enlarges our view of what's really happening here. And Lutheran congregations as a whole are not always good at talking about real things like that. I mean, we just are reticent to do that, but I think it's really important in a situation like that where there's a valuable ministry that's transitioning, but some people are somehow being hurt by the process.
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation. I think sometimes, too, it helps to sort of give people a framework and permission to do that, right? So you're not just depending on their goodwill. I mean, one of the most simple forms of a capacity inventory is this one that a lot of congregations have used. Let's talk with each other about three kinds of gifts that people have. Gifts of the head, what do you know about, what do you like to talk about, what do you like to discuss. Gifts of the hands, do you garden, do you drive, do you do sports, what do you do with your hands. And gifts of the heart, what do you care about most, right? And sometimes just sort of giving people the space and a few categories like this to talk with each other about gets people to do what, you know, what Dan's been talking about all week. How do you get to the moment where somebody looks you in the eye and that has, that changes things, right? Something can happen then.
And if you do an inventory like this with yourselves and with your guests and cross-fertilize that so that groups of people come to know each other's gifts, not as selves and guests, but as people together doing this project, then the newcomers, the guests who've taken over, can come to see the old ladies as gifts. And so,
yeah.
And so it's not patronizing the newcomers, but it's it, and saying, oh, well, now that they've taken over, we just have to let go of it or something. But it's saying, now they're in our community, and we all have to respect and love and cherish each other and value each other's gifts and feelings. You know, so it puts everyone more on equal footing instead of giving a kind of patronizing view, which would end up giving the newcomers more power than we need to.
And we've had that happen a little bit in our community. There's one guy who has started coming very regularly, is now a member of the church, and he wants to cook. And so he cooks barbecue for us every once in a while, which is great, but he makes quite a mess in the kitchen, so then the Chinese ladies get really upset because, you know, like, he's not participating the way they want him to participate. And so, you know, there is those dynamics of how do we do this? And then it's like, well, me and some other people volunteer to really help with the deep cleaning after Marcus cooks because we really want him to be able to share his gifts, and he so wants to share. I mean, he comes early to help prepare things. I mean, he really wants to be involved and to give. And so then there's ways that others of us can empower that and, you know, help with that kind of relationship between them so that it's not just one against, you know, the groups against each other, like, you know. And so maybe there's a role for empowering between those two groups, you know, to help with this gift inventory, find ways to bridge some of those, you know, frustrations between people too, I think, because that's, you know, it's been really helpful for me to be like, okay, here's where I can be a part of this, because some days I don't feel like I should participate in the cleaning because I'm not doing a good enough job, and they really like to do it their way, you know, and they're really into it. It's just like, you know what, we'll take over on the day when you don't want to be there because you get frustrated. So, you know, finding those ways to be in between too is good.
Two real brief comments about this. One is, think about how you belong to a community or a congregation. What are the characteristics of belonging? And I think somewhere at the core of this belonging idea is the notion that somebody values who you are, what your gifts are, and opens up the possibility that you can contribute. In a sense, we belong to communities that activate our contributions, right? And I think so part of this challenge is how do we open up a set of opportunities for people to contribute their gifts. A second quick comment. This makes me think a lot about the challenges of leadership within a congregation, within a community doing this kind of work. Those of you who know about community organizing know that there is something called the iron rule. You know the iron rule of community organizing? It is very simply, never do for somebody else what they can do for themselves. Never do for somebody else what they can do for themselves. So the organizer is constantly, again, creating opportunities for people to act. And often for people who haven't been asked to act before. Another way we sometimes think about this, maybe we're thinking about this mainly with people who are funders and people in government, that the challenge often is how do you lead by stepping back? So that the challenge of leadership is creating the space for other people to act. And if you're the mayor or if you're the public official, you don't have to be at the center of every ribbon cutting picture. You can be in the background and give credit to people who have actually stepped forward to do the kind of work, right? The best pastors know how to do this, know how to lead by stepping back and creating the opportunity for people to really take over their roles in the congregation.
It's all about power sharing. You
sure.
talk about sense of
that's right.
And just, you know, Christ said that if you want to be, you must be the servant.
That's
servant.
Right.
But what I see is I think that the old Norwegian model of church has been, we are a church because we like each other, we like the same things, we are alike. Whereas we are actually called as a church to not gather because we gather with people we like. That's not the church. And this, you know, the iron rule is usually who has the iron rule.
That's right.
So,
exactly.
But that is not who we are called to be as a church. And again, if the church is Christ-centered, I am not centered in me and my gifts, and I am free to allow. There's many, many balances that are going to be thrown off balance.
That's right.
And you've got to challenge every day. But then, that's what makes life exciting.
That's right.
Peace is not an easy thing.
You make me think a little bit about one of my favorite definitions of a healthy community, which I think may apply to a healthy congregation as well. And it comes out of the writings of Parker Palmer, who I think is a wonderful commentator on Our Lives Together. And he says at some point, you'll know a good community when you see that it is in constant tension. It has, it's a tension between walls and windows. You need walls because you need to know when you're in it. So we are being somewhat alive. And it's ethnicity, but it's also faith, and it's, you know, what makes clear that we're in it. But you can't have just walls, or it's going to be defensive, and it could get ugly in lots of ways. So you need windows.
Well, yeah, just love is a gift and lives that you put up here. Because all of the things you ask for are positive.
That's it, absolutely right.
And you're not allowing the negative to be part of the discussion.
That's
you better
right.
leave them at the door.
That's right. And this is particularly powerful when you're dealing with people who have only had the other experience.
Right.
Where people are continually asking, what grade have you failed lately? What can't you do? Right? What, tell us the latest crimes you've committed. You've got a stack of those kinds of interview formats. For example, with young people. The first time a young person gets in trouble with the juvenile justice system, somebody will sit them down and do the opposite of this. They'll say, tell me how often you thought about suicide. Tell me about your alcohol use. Tell me about your drug use. How often were you abused as a child? Tell me about your gang affiliation, right? And that's the normal way that authoritative institutions in our culture deal with folks, particularly on the margins. And this is a way of demarginalizing people by recognizing their fullness and opening up the possibility that they can be valuable contributors.
That is, by the way, certainly what I work with people on death row or facing the death penalty, and that's how I always start all my interviews with them is, tell me about what you're good at, and tell me about what you love.
Because they haven't been asked that, right?
The hands of their, and it just completely undoes them. You know, they're disarmed, they're happy, you're holding a mirror up to them that says you're a whole person, you're a child of God. Not a mirror that says you're a shattered, fragmented, deficient, horrible person. Which is what you open the food pantry and you're giving charity because you are a needy person.
That's right.
And I'm a bunny because I can give to you.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is really, really wrong. We're not helping them be whole people and whole members of society.
Yeah.
It's fun to listen to a Bible study on 'tis more blessed to give than to receive. You know, to do a Bible study in your congregation on that. And why do we feel so blessed to be able to give and be in the power, the whole, the
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in pastors now who have begun doing some version of a capacity inventory with every new member. So that the minute you come into this congregation, we know what you've got to contribute. But I think that the second step of that is equally important, and that is to do something with what you do find out.
Yeah. And that's the part that takes all the energy.
Boy, if it's just information that gathers dust on the shelf, it in fact will turn people off. Like, you know, you asked me all these questions, I told you all the things that I like to do and that I can't do, and I haven't ever heard from you yet. So there has to be, you know, a gift mobilization process of some kind in congregations.
But aren't sometimes people hesitant to give you their phones because they're afraid you're going to...
You're going to ask for something?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to make it very clear that the ask is going to be there, but it's perfectly okay if you say no. this is up to... We want to take advantage of your energies and interests, not force someone.
In a congregation that Jody talks about sometimes, they took a Polaroid picture of each person, and under the Polaroid had a tight list of their gifts, and put them all up in the parish hall. And so that you could wander around and see all the things that your fellow members are about and can do, and then they started to group and, you know, mobilize.
I think when people are afraid that you have these outsiders come in, they are taking over, then I will not be done. I'm not needed anymore. The people that have been there all their lives. So that also has to be acknowledged and addressed, and that can't be allowed to happen.
Right. And space has to be created for people who have been around as well. Right.
Well, and I think that's an affirmation process, too. When people do get involved, you really affirm what they're doing. I know
that's
my pastor's really good at this, and I kind of sometimes think, oh, you're being so repetitive, but it's really good because he's been creative with, like, there's a guy in our church who leads a Saturday morning basketball program. I mean, the only affiliation with the church is that this guy runs it, and it happens in our church gym. You know, it's not like we're putting energy or money or anything into it, but he affirms that every time we talk about, I mean, he brings it up and affirms that this guy's doing this community program, you know, and we affirm the people who clean up after the meals, and we, you know, we have youth choirs use our facilities during the week, and instead of just having it as a rental agreement, we invite them to participate in our services, even though they're not Christian youth choirs. We're like, oh, we'd love to hear some of your songs, you know, so we have a special music Sunday, and we have them sing with us, you know, and so there's ways to affirm the community connections and the ways that members are participating in really positive ways, you know, so that other people recognize what's going on, too, without just letting it be something that goes unnoticed or something people feel they're giving, but also that they're being affirmed and recognized for what they're contributing.
This is how teachers basically treat pastors.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's kind of a full circle thing that we need to just continue doing this. Yeah.
That's right. Well, I think we have run out of time, and it's lunchtime. Hopefully these conversations can continue without a formal session. Thanks for the story, Chad.